You know, I was thinking the other day, you know, there's something to playing by your own rules. And you know where that something gets you? You end up being single, a bit of a loner, a slight drunk, and living in a tiny apartment with terrible air conditioning in Sunnyvale. But you know what? Things are going to change. And hopefully within 5 or 6 months, it'll be totally different. I'll be single, a bit of a loner, a slight drunk, and living in a tiny apartment with terrible air conditioning, but in Los Angeles. Will I be happy? I mean, probably not, but I will be happier, and that's something. And as I have said, I'm continually working on, you know, hoping to meet someone, and yes, I'm cutting back on the drinking. I mean, life is basically just working on things, trying to be better, trying to have a good life, you know, and when the work ends, that's when you die. So I'm going to keep at it. And sometimes I kind of look at how I'm living, and I think, wow, would my dad, like, be ashamed of me? But maybe he would understand. I think my dad would know I'm doing my best. And at least I'm not hurting anyone. But my mom, she sticks with me through thick and thin, and I drive her nuts. And to be honest, this hasn't been one of my greatest weeks. I haven't been very productive, didn't even watch many movies. Sometimes I just cannot turn my mind off, and once in a while I have to somehow turn it off for a while, but it always comes at a cost. So yeah, none of us are perfect, but I think at least recognizing our problems or our demons or whatever is something, and then consciously working on trying to solve those problems is something also, you know, not giving in. We make progress, we fuck up, we keep working at it, and hopefully the fuck-ups decrease. And speaking of lost weekends, Billy Wilder's 1945 The Lost Weekend is just a classic. It stars Ray Milland as a writer who's on the wagon, but then goes on an epic four-day bender that may be his last. And the derivation of the phrase on the wagon is a bit murky, but it may be when water wagons traveled around with like water just used for damping dusty streets, and people who were like abstaining from alcohol were like, I'd rather drink from the wagon than have alcohol. Thus, they were being on the wagon. But anyway, The Lost Weekend is based on Charles R. Jackson's 1944 novel based on his own history of alcoholism. It's a tragic tale. It's a must-see. But an absolute classic that I literally could only watch once is 1962's Days of Wine and Roses, directed by Blake Edwards. It was also just on Broadway as a musical, actually. I would have liked to have seen that, but the movie tears me apart. I mean, it stars Jack Lemmon and just an absolutely gorgeous Lee Remick as a young, ambitious couple who get married. They have a kid. He kind of gets her to start drinking. They have some fun, but then it just turns dark. Jack Lemmon ends up in a sanitarium a couple times. Their marriage falls apart. And it's got one of the most tragic endings of a movie I can remember. I literally can tear up when I think about it. But it's so worth watching. It's just great acting, great direction. And the movie just looks great with an end scene that will, like, devastate you. And I haven't talked about boxing for a little bit. So let's start with a great quote by the legend, Gentleman Jim Corbett, who famously was the only man who ever beat John L. Sullivan. Thus, Corbett was known as the man who beat the man. And he has a great quote about perseverance. To paraphrase, fight one more round. When your arms are so tired that you can hardly lift your hands, fight one more round. When your nose is bleeding and your eyes are black and you are so tired that you wish your opponent would crack you on the jaw and put you to sleep, fight one more round. Remembering that the man who always fights one more round is never whipped. Nice one, Gentleman Jim. So let's talk of a violent and twisted night from my youth and whatever else I think of as we go.
You are my density. You are my density.
Okay, before we get into the heart of darkness, some news flashes. The legendary baseball player Willie Mays died recently. He of the catch, the incredible over-the-shoulder snag in center field in 1954. Willie Mays was dubbed the Say Hey Kid, supposedly because of his youthful exuberance, and he would often say hey when he was younger. And so the nickname stuck. It was actually a song as well, if you can believe it. Say Hey, the Willie Mays song by the Treniers in 1954. He was a class act and just one of the first black superstars. He will be missed. And he was supposedly a great storyteller as well. I read a story he told once that I guess when he was first starting out and he was in the Negro Leagues, as it was called back then, and Willie Mays, I think he was like a teenager, and he was facing an aging Satchel Paige, another legend, and Paige was pitching. And I guess the first time up at bat, Willie Mays hit a double. The second time he was up, Paige literally walked up like halfway to home plate and said to Willie Mays, I'm going to throw three fastballs and you're going to go sit down. And Mays was kind of thinking to himself, he's like, yeah, right, you threw me three fastballs. I'm going to hit one of them. So Page threw two fastballs and Mays swung and missed. And then on the third ball, Page threw it and he started walking and literally said, go sit down, as the ball was in the air and Mays swung and missed. I mean, what a goddamn story. And I had mentioned Donald Sutherland kind of being a jerk to someone I knew at a sound mixing studio, but, you know, Donald Sutherland just died and I never met the guy, so rest in peace. I mean, we all have our good moments and bad moments. I'm sure I've been an asshole to people in my past. I try not to do that anymore. I'm only an asshole to myself these days. But check out the creepy as hell Don't Look Now from 1974, directed by Nicholas Roeg, with Donald Sutherland and a gorgeous Julie Christie as a couple grieving the death of their daughter. He starts to see this spooky as hell like little figure in the streets wearing a red coat similar to the one their daughter was wearing when she died. It's got a famously controversial sex scene, and the ending is just a shocker. A couple of other passings of note. Morgan Spurlock, the documentarian of Super Size Me fame, died not long ago. Man, what a huge documentary that was at the time. It kind of became controversial later because I guess Morgan Spurlock was actually drinking pretty heavily at the time. So the results of his like all McDonald's diet, you know, was kind of not trustworthy. But either way, eating McDonald's every day ain't too good for you. And I guess Spurlock did, you know, some reprehensible things in the past, including some sexual abuse. But the guy did publicly confess and he tried to kind of make some amends. And if he had simply just said nothing, his reputation probably would have survived. But the guy had the balls to like fully admit he was wrong. It doesn't excuse his actions, but it did seem he tried to address his wrongs. I mean, he clearly fucked up, but you know, he seemed human about it and he did seem pained at least. His confessions pretty much ended his career and he died recently of cancer at age 53. And, you know, I can honestly say I've never really been like sleazy to a woman. There was one time in like advertising when I was at a party and I kind of misread some signs and I gave a perhaps unwanted kiss to someone and it kind of got weird and I apologized. And every time I saw her, you know, at the sound mixing place later on, I just felt like so shameful. I mean, she was cool to me and it wasn't a big deal, but it's just like I never let that happen again to me. And lastly, another towering sports figure who recently died was the fearsome Oakland Raiders center, Jim Otto, at age 86. The guy was ferocious. I guess he underwent 70 football-related operations due to the damage his body took. Something like 30 concussions, 25 broken noses, a broken jaw, broken ribs, just an old-school, scary motherfucker. He wore number 00, kind of a play on his name, Otto. Ought meaning zero and oh, Otto. Pretty clever if that's true. But a seriously tough dude whose majority of his life was spent in constant pain. So rest in peace, Jim Otto. And his teammate, Gene Upshaw, had a funny quote about him. He said, you could always recognize him because he was always bleeding. And his former coach, John Madden, so insightfully said, he was an Iron Man, but added, an Iron Man pays for it later. And weirdly enough, my dad was a tailor back in the day in Oakland. I had mentioned he made some suits for George Foreman. He also made some suits for some old school San Francisco 49ers and for Satan himself, the Oakland Raiders owner Al Davis, whose son Mark Davis is the controlling owner of the now Las Vegas Raiders. Like I've said, my hair sucks, but Mark Davis has perhaps the worst haircut in the history of all fucking time, like from the beginning of time. Please check it out. It's a complete disaster. And moving the Raiders to Vegas, I mean, come on. I mean, the Oakland Raiders were just badass. And the badass cornerback from the Oakland Raiders back in the day, Lester Hayes, absurdly used to wear this substance called Stick'Em, basically all over his fucking hands and arms. It was a glue-like substance, and circa 1981, the NFL instituted a rule change that banned the substance. Another legendary and amazingly named Oakland Raider from the 70s, Fred Biletnikoff, also used a lot of this Stick'Em stuff. But yeah, look up some pictures from the era with the Stick'Em stuff, and you'll be like, how is this allowed for like even 5 minutes? And speaking lastly on football, you know, once in a while in this crazy world, you really see true love. And when you see it, it's truly magical. I'm speaking, of course, of the former Patriots coach Bill Belichick, age 72, and his new girlfriend Jordan Hudson, age 24, and an ex-cheerleader. I mean, they seem so perfectly matched, so much in common, so many similar references. I mean, they can talk about, and of course, I'm kidding, they look ridiculous together. He looks like Shrek, and he's legendarily a complete asshole jerk, and she looks pretty, and Pretty Vacant, but who knows? And Pretty Vacant is also a classic Sex Pistols song from the 1977 album Nevermind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols. But yeah, it seems like, you know, get ready for it, kind of an offensive foul to me. But it's not illegal, so hey, you two, have fun. You look ridiculous, and it's slightly embarrassing, but, you know, go for it. Okay, back to some real-life Northern California noir, A Calamity in Concord, starring me and some other idiots. This was like the early 90s. I was still in college, I think, but I was visiting my parents up in Northern California. It was probably a holiday or something. And there was this kind of sleazy bar in Concord. It hadn't been there long. It wasn't like old school or anything. It was more like a lame sports bar. So I was hanging there one night. There were a few of my friends there, but the guys I was hanging out with, I knew. But, you know, I didn't know super well. So it was pretty crowded. We were drinking, being stupid, playing pool. And at one point, we went to the parking lot and bought some like absolute bottom of the barrel speed from some guy we'd went to high school with. I mean, this was some seriously backwoods bathtub speed. I mean, it was brown colored. And the guy that sold us to us was not really NASA material, if you know what I mean. But anyway, we all did a bit of it and things got a little bit heightened and more intense, but things were about to go totally haywire. So we were playing pool and one of the guys I was hanging with was a year younger than me. Fairly kind of stocky, tough kid. But at the bar that night, there was this one guy who was just legendarily a badass in school. I mean, the guy like exuded toughness like no one I've ever seen. And he was never really a jerk to me or anything. But I just remember in the halls at high school when he would walk down, like everyone would part ways like the Red Sea as he walked by. It was such like a John Hughes, you know, moment with me as Anthony Michael Hall. It's like, ooh, ooh, ooh. I remember seeing the guy fight someone in the boys' bathroom in junior high. It was brutal. I couldn't even watch the whole thing. I remember one guy like got thrown into a urinal. Ugh. But anyway, the guy I was hanging with foolishly said something or other to the tough guy. And it was pretty much game over. There was a brief scuffle and the tough guy like flattened my buddy, broke his nose. Then everyone kind of broke it up. But there was this absolutely De Palma-ish or like Scorsese-ish detail that I will never forget. I had been standing next to the jukebox next to this other guy that I went to high school with. It was like probably the other toughest guy I knew at the time. This guy was like tough as shit, but he was definitely troubled. Had some mental problems, but, you know, he was a nice guy, I thought. So anyway, I can't exactly remember the chronology, but maybe like right after the fight, this tough friend of mine was drinking and he kind of broke the glass against something. He kind of did impulsive stuff like that and he cut his hand all up. And anyway, I saw that he was still holding the broken glass and there was some music playing and neon lights. And I just kind of zeroed into the image of his hand slowly filling the glass with blood. I mean, it's just like an indelible image in my brain, as intense and just as cinematic as ever anything I've ever seen on the big screen, with the music and the lights and just, oh, unbelievable. So anyway, after the fight, we all jumped into somebody's car to go to the Kaiser Hospital to have my buddy checked out. And talk about a Goodfellas-ish scene, I shit you not, while my friend was in the emergency room, the rest of us went to the bathroom in the hospital and did a little more of that absolutely awful speed. We should have listened to Robert De Niro talking to Ray Liotta in Goodfellas. Stop with the fucking drugs. They're turning your mind into mush. I finally made it back to my parents and probably slept for 12 hours. And speed just gives you the nastiest hangover ever. So I was done with that shit. But anyway, this night was kind of the end of a chapter or kind of a wake-up call to start like growing up a little. And stop getting myself into bad or stupid situations. My parents raised me better than that, so it's kind of shameful to me a bit. And my parents were always classy, but I've had some admittedly low-class periods of my life. And there's probably been some times where I probably missed out on some super great experiences because of me doing some stupid shit. And one of the most heartbreaking lines out of so many amazing and sad Elliott Smith songs is a line from The Last Hour, which was released posthumously in 2004 on the album From a Basement on the Hill. Anyway, it's Elliott Smith basically, you know, talking about missing good shit while he was doing dumb shit. The line is, I've been thinking of the things that I've missed, situations that I passed up for this. And am I the only person that, like, thinks of Elliott Smith almost on a daily basis? I mean, I also think about a million other things a day, but oh well, that's my brain, I suppose. Okay, changing topics here. Man, working in a psych hospital could be rough at times. I mean, it can be annoying, it can be exhausting, but every once in a while, something so gut-wrenchingly real happens, and it can just knock the wind out of you. I'll never forget, and sorry if I'm repeating this here, a really kind of psychotic woman walked up to another patient who was using the phone. I kind of walked over there because she had like almost hit someone earlier in the day, so I wasn't sure what to expect. And she just said to him, "Will you be my friend?" And he said, "Yes." And they walked down the hall and just kind of talked to each other. And I was just like, wow. And like I said, I may have told that story before. My apologies if I did. And I was talking with a patient in the involuntary unit, and she mentioned liking the movie Wings of Desire. And I was like, what? Whoa, wait a minute. That's a pretty deep cut. I mean, Wings of Desire is a 1987 romantic comedy by Wim Wenders, as with Bruno Ganz as an angel in the streets of Berlin. He falls in love, and he wants to live in the physical world. It's also got Peter Falk playing himself. It looks completely great. It's beautiful at times, sad and funny. But it's a gem. And so anyway, I said to her, wow, that's a cool movie. And she was probably in her, you know, late 20s. So I like respected that she even knew about it. And sometimes movies or jokes are the way I can kind of communicate with patients in the hospital. And in all sincerity, I think I'm a pretty good psych nurse because I think patients can see that I'm like damaged a bit. Like they can sense, we're all suffering a little bit. And beneath my bloodshot eyes, I think they can see like a sincerity and some kind of vulnerability. You can't really fake that. And they know I'm not going to bullshit them. And again, I don't want to be a psych nurse forever, but it has had its rewards, and it's made me even more sensitive than I was before, for better or worse. So anyway, it had been a couple weeks or so, and I was back in the involuntary unit, kind of just visiting the guys over there. And the girl patient was still there, and she came up to me and said, "Hey, could you make a list of movies like Wings of Desire so that she could watch them when she got out of the hospital?" And something about that just kind of hit me. I was like, ah, something about the fact she, you know, remembered our conversation, but more so just, you know, having this list of movies to watch when she got out of this locked psych hospital. It was just a completely human moment. And quickly, just the other day at the hospital, there was a helicopter landing on their roof, I guess, with someone. And I was watching it and I'm like, God, helicopters are so fucking weird. They've always freaked me out. And I always think of Martin Sheen's character at the beginning of Apocalypse Now, where he looks out of his window and sees helicopters and he's like, "Saigon, shit, I'm still only in Saigon." But anyway, while we're on the subject of human moments, let's roll with it for a moment, why don't we? I read recently about a set of conjoined twins. They were named Lori and George. They died at age 62, but the doctors only thought they would like live to maybe 30. They both had distinct brains, but they were joined at the skull. But get this, George went for years as Lori worked in a hospital laundry. And for a while, George tried to pursue a country western singing career. And Lori was like a really good bowler. But anyway, just kind of a sweet, heartbreaking detail was like when Lori would go on dates, George would bring books to read. There's something so sweet about that detail. And the fact that they stuck together, pardon that pun, but that they, you know, just lived together and they, you know, persevered through it is like unbelievable to me. And anyway, I remember I went to the Getty Museum last year to see the Cy Twombly exhibit. And on the way out, I got into the elevator with a group of kids with Down syndrome. And they had a couple people like, you know, chaperoning them. And this cute little kid, you know, came up to me, smiled, and he put out his hand to me and I took his hand. And the chaperone said, "Remember, Jimmy," or whatever, "stranger danger." And I was like, oh, it's okay. And I understand how like people can be dangerous, of course, and terrible, but it was just kind of a heartbreaking moment. The fact that this little kid with Down syndrome like needs to be afraid of strangers is just like an indictment of just how rotten people can be at times. I mean, in a perfect world, people wouldn't fear each other, but I mean, hey, we know this world is far from perfect. But it was just kind of sad to me and it stuck with me. And when he got out of the elevator, I made a goofy face at him and he smiled. And I was like, wow, what a just nice, innocent moment. So like I said, I had had a kind of a wasteful week, slightly self-destructive, and I was feeling not so hot. But once again, a ridiculously horrible but amazing movie from 2002 came to the rescue. It's called Dead in a Heartbeat. It stars Judge Reinhold as a cop. And Judge Reinhold was famously a cop in the four Beverly Hills movies, including the soon-to-be-released Beverly Hills Cop Axel F., which I'm hoping will be good. Eddie Murphy was kind of one of those guys that was just so funny, so raw when he was young and hungry, but then he lost some of his energy and frankly some of his comic powers as he got older, but I know he still got the goods. But yeah, Dead in a Heartbeat is utterly nutty with Penelope Ann Miller, who's unwittingly a doctor putting in pacemakers that actually have like little built-in bombs that can be remotely detonated. It is so dumb, but it's so good, and it made me feel a little better. But I do know I have to start getting my shit together. I know it. Hopefully this episode was enjoyable to someone out there. But anyway, let's end with a song that I've always loved. It's such a pretty song. It's called Beautiful One from the 1995 album Life by the Cardigans. The Cardigans are a Swedish band with the lead singer Nina Persson. God, what a lovely voice. But yeah, just a great song and a fantastic chorus. And I will see you next week, my beautiful ones. Soft beams from an early sun on my truly beautiful one. Shimmer from a Saturday sun on my truly beautiful one. Na 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 na